maybe not so much, especially if you're so focused on, having your business survive.
May I highlight, we touched on something, but I think this is actually an opportunity that most folks don't recognize that is kind of newer, is synthetic data to train models.
We're going through something absolutely historic.
Technologies across the board are growing exponentially.
It's a disruption that's going to completely redefine the way businesses compete.
In the next decade, we're going to lose 40% of today's Fortune 500 companies.
The exponential growth of computing is continuing.
AI is nowhere near its full potential.
Whether you like it or not, that the future cannot be stopped by anyone.
Hi there, everybody. This is Mark Verbenkov, and welcome to the Future Tech and Foresight podcast. This is going to be episode number 134, and it was actually recorded on the anniversary of ChatGPT's launch. So I thought it would be a good little idea to, as a small homage to my all-time favorite AI tool, to kind of look over the past year and kind of pick out some of the highlights of ChatGPT. Also, it will be a nice kind of tie-in to what we'll be discussing later on today in the interview portion of the podcast. So firstly, we can start off with the premium service ChatGPT Plus that was launched. And for somebody who uses ChatGPT daily, and for, I guess, any of you power users out there, it's given us significantly more access, especially during peak usage times, which is, some of the most important times to actually be using this thing. Now, this was shortly followed thereafter with, I think, one of the most, if not the most important thing with regards to ChatGPT, and that's GPT-4's release. And this was back in March. And this, I think, as well as many of the people that have come onto the podcast before, have stated that this has been nothing short of extraordinary. It's been bringing enhanced understanding, nuance, and even some of the guests have said, creativity to AI interactions, which at the very least has made my work significantly more interesting, not to mention efficient and enjoyable. And I'm sure the same thing can be said for any of you that have been using it. So shortly thereafter, we were given access to the ChatGPT plugin store. And I think the thing that I've been using ChatGPT with for the most is the ability for it to browse the internet, making it, I think, significantly more useful than its previous 2021 data cutoff point where, you would type in something, ask it, whatever, and it would say, sorry, unable to kind of comply because the data that I have was cut off in 2021 and I don't have more recent data. So with the internet browsing, it's been much more useful as a tool. And I think one of the more, I guess you could say, unappreciated aspects of ChatGPT over the last year or so has been its release of the multimodal capabilities. This is allowing ChatGPT to not just understand text, which is what I think most of us use it for, but also images and other types of data like video, etc., not to mention programming and coding. And this, I think, has opened up new possibilities for AI applications in diverse fields, from the creative arts to complex data analysis, which I think we've been hearing about quite a bit over the last couple of months, especially. Furthermore, ChatGPT's expansion into mobile platforms and its enhanced voice interaction capabilities have brought AI into our daily lives like never before, which kind of ties into what we'll be talking a little bit about in today's episode with my guest, but more on that in just a second here. So with these voice commands and it being on our mobile apps, it's actually making AI in general, not just ChatGPT, but AI in general, much more accessible and integrated into our everyday activities, which I think is one of the larger trends that we'll be seeing over the next couple of years, that kind of seamless integration with our lives. And the internet, I guess you could say, is one of the first steps. Now we'll be seeing that with AI capabilities significantly more. But during this time, ChatGPT obviously has been the the main and dominant player, but we've also seen this, the space in general, like the generative AI space, kind of explode with a lot of other competitors or similar tools like Google Bard, Cloud, Perplexity, Jasper, and a whole host of other competitors, both from large organizations, but also from smaller ones. And I guess we could also include things like Runway and Midjourney, which is for video generation and image generation, which has been really interesting. And I've personally been using Midjourney quite a bit over the last year for the podcast as well. So I guess we could summarize all this by saying that the AI space, or the generative AI space in particular, has been quite alive in the past year, in 2023. And the real launch of the generative AI hype has truly begun, mostly because of ChatGPT's release. So to discuss not only these kinds of innovations and the space in general, but also where generative AI will most likely lead us into the near future, is my guest, Steve Marsunek. He is a serial entrepreneur and co-founder and general manager of Intelligent Relations. So we don't just talk about ChatGPT today. We also talk about this concept of connected AI, which Steve will get into details about. We talk about innovations in the generative AI space, but also what the future of generative AI, ChatGPT, and these other tools that I've mentioned will look like, especially as they start seeping into the products and tools that we use every single day, which I think is really, really interesting. So a little bit about Intelligent Relations, and then we can jump into the discussion with Steve. So Intelligent Relations specializes in assisting startups and growing tech companies to grow their online presence. Through the innovative use of AI, Steve and his team help these companies to win more media coverage, increase their online presence, implement executive brand building, and ultimately drive more traffic, more website traffic and conversions towards them. But more relevantly for the podcast today, as the co-founder and chief architect of what they're calling their Preston AI platform, Steve coordinates daily operations, implements the company's strategic initiatives, and is responsible for driving organizational growth, while most relevantly, keeping pace with the innovations in the AI space and leveraging these innovations to improve his products and keep Intelligent Relations competitive. So I really found the conversation today to be quite interesting. I hope that you do as well. And you, as usual, get something out of these conversations as we explore emerging technology and, of course, artificial intelligence as time goes on. Thanks. Hi there, Steve. Thank you very much for coming onto the podcast today to talk about what is slowly, or quickly, I should say, becoming one of my favorite conversation topics, generative AI and I guess AI in general. So thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So as I just mentioned, one of the questions that I like to ask all guests to start off the conversation with is, what initially got you interested in the topic, in the industry that you're getting involved in, which is generative AI and AI?
Yeah, so I'll go back a little bit further even. So I first knew I had an interest in technology when I was in school, in probably middle school, early high school, and we had those old school TI-83 graphing calculators. And it was this cool new tool that, you know, could make graphs, could do basic stuff like that. But I realized that you could also use it to code. And while we were learning things like quadratic equations and stuff like that, I realized, hey, I can program a program. I can build a program that if I give it basic information, it can solve some of these math problems for me. And then I don't have to do this routine activity over and over and over again. I can just plug in the information I need and it'll help to compute and give me the output that I'm looking for. So flash forward a fair amount from there. I've always had this interest in how do I optimize processes? How do I do things better, quicker, and just been an enthusiastic dabbler in all things tech. While my background is academically more in the marketing entrepreneurship side, I've always been really an enthusiastic deconstructor of workflows and trying to figure out how I can use technology in workflows to do things better and more effectively. So the specific journey I'm on now in building Intelligent Relations, using artificial intelligence to streamline, enhance the public relations process, you know, reaching out to journalists with good story ideas. That started about 4 years ago when we started to hear these whispers of generative AI coming out of Silicon Valley, et cetera. And coming from a PR background, having done marketing and public relations for the last 10 years, I was like, oh man, this is like, PR is a good use case for this kind of tech. Because what does AI need? Generally, it needs data. Mm-hmm. In the PR industry, all the data is public. Heck, you know, data from published articles is part of what has been used to train these large language models. Right. So that's is like, this is great. I can analyze articles to understand what journalists actually care about, or do a deep dive on a publication based on, you know, their previous coverage. And there's a lot there. So started to hack away at the workflows back in 2020 around technology that was like super, yeah, super introductory, not very good, but it was kind of this fun exercise of, you know, take article, analyze in this way, insert good AI here, good generative AI here, next step, next step, next step. And, you know, I guess we made some bets in terms of where the technology was going. And thankfully, many of them have played out as well or better than expected in terms of what the tech would be capable of. So that's kind of where we're at, and having a lot of fun in our application workflow.
Great, great. Well, yeah, we'll definitely get into the deconstruction of different processes and operations. I think that's going to be one of the core points of today's discussion. I've had a couple interviews recently on the podcast. I don't think I've published all of them yet, but a lot of them have obviously been focused on generative AI, and a lot of people say they have different, I don't know if fascination is the right word, but maybe like shock value moments of paying attention to the generative AI space over the last couple of years and seeing like new innovations come up and being like, wow, like this is fantastic. Of course, the big one for the world is ChatGPT, or the launch of ChatGPT, which, if I'm not mistaken, we're recording this on November 30th. So it's like exactly a year ago.
They have their little birthday hat anniversary in the in the playground. Yeah,
right, right. So that, of course, is the main one that kind of got the world on moving along with ChatGPT. How about you? You've been in the space for a couple of years. Have there been a couple of these, maybe not light bulb moments, but shocking or interesting moments over the last couple of years where new innovations have kind of made you think, wow, like this is actually really interesting, and it can kind of see where the industry is moving forward?
Yeah. So close to home for me was we use generative AI to write drafts of emails to journalists based on factual information that's useful for them, et cetera. And the first time that I was running all of this in sandbox kind of environments, and we drafted an email to the Washington Post. We got a positive reply from a journalist at the Washington Post in response to an email that, yes, was fact-checked and all that stuff, but was written by generative AI. And he was like, yeah, sure, sounds great. I'd love to talk to your client. I was like, that was my first, can I say holy shit?
Yeah,
moment?
Of course.
Yeah, okay. That's my first, like, holy shit, like, we might have something here. That's very personal to our workflow and work case, but it was a demonstration of, yeah, in terms of transactional interactive content that helps to move forward a process that could be accelerated, is like, yeah, this works. We're effectively communicating an idea and information to someone who wants that information idea, and it's achieving its desired outcome. I think that most recently, the one for me that I'm up all night playing with the team is assistants and GPTs out of OpenAI. We'll probably go into more detail there, but we've been sensing for a while, like the first real application in my framing, the first real application of generative AI was you can give it prompts and then it'll give you a return, and it's a fixed limited scope return of text. Then chat and chat with systems prompts and few shot learning as part of like an interactive dialogue was that ChatGPT moment. And you're like, okay, I can interact with it and I can kind of train it in a way that previously wasn't possible and you know, give feedback. And that was like a next stage. And then we've been sensing for a while and seeing early indications that integrating that interface, that experience of interactive activity with a large language model that has access to other information, integrated, connected technology, that was like, clearly that's happening. Clearly that's where people wanted to go. You saw these early things in the ChatGPT, in the OpenAI store, like you can use it to search for flight and kayak. Cool, nice little application. I mean, that sounds like, you know, very early internet stuff, like, oh, isn't it cute that you can search for a flight using ChatGPT? And we're going to get far past that very quickly. But it's like, yeah, that's obviously next. So we're going to see more of those developments of the power of the model. But for me, this connectivity of how it can be integrated, that is one of the next game changers that we're really keen on.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah, I think I definitely want to dive into that maybe a little bit later in the episode.
Sure.
So as we talked about before, this idea of deconstructing processes in a business, I think is something very interesting. I also don't think I've touched on it too much on the podcast before. So maybe we could focus in on this a little bit. And you could start off by explaining maybe some of the things that you're looking for of where it's relevant to even start thinking about like where AI could be placed once a process is deconstructed. So maybe we can start there.
Happy to give a case study from us. And again, like the application we're focused on is about public relations and email outreach, but it's the world that we're focused on. And the idea is that this hopefully is of value to folks who are well outside of our niche application. So for us, we started by deconstructing the process of what does it take to get a journalist interested in a story about a client. So we have a client, I'll use an example. It's a company in the data privacy space. They're called Delete Me. They do data removal from data brokers. If you search your name and you find your every address you've ever lived at and phone number and mother's maiden name and an ex-girlfriend connected with your profile, it's like you might want to get that taken down. So that's what Delete Me does, is they remove online information. And our aim for them would be to pitch journalists and get coverage for them. So let's look at the deconstruction process of that. You got to start off by understanding the client. What do they do? What's interesting about them, et cetera. So there's like, that's chunk number one, workflow stuff. So chunk number one, understand the client. Step number two is going to be to write an email to a journalist based on what they do. There's probably this intermediary step of find something interesting about the client. So yeah, step one, understand the client. Step two, understand what's interesting about the client, which may be different. Step three, put that in a pitch in the appropriate way. Step four would be to find the right journalists who actually care about that. You have the best idea and the best pitch in the world, but if you're pitching a cybersecurity story to someone who writes about pets, they're probably never going to write an article about you unless... I could imagine
Sort of weird crossover there.
It could be it happens. Yeah. And then there's the coordination of the win and the publication that comes after that. So that would be like the deconstruction of the process. And I think we started this conversation by focusing on generative AI, but obviously generative AI is just one type of artificial intelligence. And there's a lot of other things that would be completely relevant to work into those workflows. So, understanding the client, that is probably a document processing, knowledge gathering, document processing kind of problem. So you can understand a client or at least give knowledge transfer to a system by uploading documents, scraping website information, analyzing social media coverage, that type of thing. And so you can if you store that and process that in the right way, you would be able to capture that. And that's a matter of scraping, vectorization, analysis, tagging, concepts, concept analysis. There's certain kinds of models and algorithms you can run on that. understanding what's interesting, that for us right now is one of the hardest problems. What's interesting is an abstract and somewhat very subjective concept, I'd say. So we can analyze news media and see what people are writing about. That's a proxy for what's interesting. You know, you can analyze what's getting traction in terms of social media shares, for example, trends. But interesting is still something where, like, we can prompt, here's some story ideas, here's 12 of them. But having a human who's in the loop to say, like, yeah, that's actually good and coherent, that's an area that we're less optimistic could be fully systematized using AI. The writing of content, that's a straight generative AI issue. A lot of concerns in our space in particular. So hallucinations and PR is big no-no, you know, if you're fabricating information. So step four, so the next step in the process would be writing an email to journalists, and that's a straight generative AI problem that we're kind of talking about. So you got, for us, it's about writing in a specific form with a specific style and tone. Those are all considerations. But of course, factual accuracy is really important in PR. You can't have hallucinations in a pitch. You can't be pitching things that are not true, or that's, I mean, that's devastating to your reputation as a company or as a PR pro. So you have to have some safeguards in place there, including human oversight, frankly. And then journalist identification, you would have the process of seeing, you know, there's a number of different ways. I could go into a little more detail on how we do it, but matching, topic matching, there's a number of different ways you could recommend who would be relevant for this. And then further down, we're not as focused on, it's more about finding and helping and supporting on the right pitch. But for us, that is an example of end to end. What does good look like? What is the standard? And for me, it usually would start with, what is the human need for each of these processes? And then, is there a technology solution that either directly addresses that or serves as a proxy to it? Maybe, maybe not yet, maybe never. And it's, how do you assemble those pieces to create a workflow that offers real value? And to me, that just one last thing on that is that it is that leap from novelty to offering real value that I think is where we're going to continue to evolve generative AI is interesting to generative AI is an integral part of workflows that people are willing to pay for, because it's helping them to do more than they could, save money, or do things faster.
One of the points that came up to mind when you were speaking was collecting the data from this company. So from specific companies. And I want to maybe bring this to kind of a larger, wider context here. Generative AI becomes more ubiquitous and organizations across the world become more used to using it, I think that there's going to be some ideas that propagate throughout the business world of, okay, well, I need to have these processes and operations already prepared, laid out, so that I can kind of give it to an organization such as yours where they can automate certain aspects. I don't think we're there yet. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I would perceive that many organizations aren't totally aware or prepared to kind of hand over these things to you, and that whether it's you or another, say, consultancy would go in there and actually define and kind of figure out what these operations and processes are. Could you maybe touch on that a little bit? Like, are companies ready with these processes, or do they need to be kind of, you know, handheld to figure out these processes within their own organizations?
So I think whether companies are cultivating their own internal AI teams, AI process teams, or hiring a consultancy, clearly there's a need for expertise to walk them through those processes. So that is, you know, someone with a fresh set of eyes from the outside might be better positioned, unless you have unless you have the right folks internally. So in terms of getting your data set up for the use case, I think it really depends on the use case. So we can try talking about a couple of those. So one use case is you want to train your own models. That is a case, or fine tune. You know, you're, and that is the case that most companies are probably going to do, is they're fine tuning models that are already built by third parties, because they're increasingly cheap and affordable, and it's there's not a lot of reason unless you're doing it. For most use cases, that would be fine. So let's talk about, you know, it could be a model that's writing content. For example, training a pitch generator. Here's how to write good pitches. For us, that is a model that we wanted to build on top of hundreds and hundreds and thousands of good pitches that were written by folks. And so we bootstrapped our company to a certain point. And I have a team of 20 plus PR professionals who have been doing PR activities for the last, you know, 10 plus years. Mm. So I have a good backlog of useful data to format, punch up, train, enter. You know, it's like you have to put it in a certain format, but you have that. You can do decent work with less data, but having that data from before, or creating synthetic versions of data by, like, you know, using generative AI to create 100 examples and then have humans go through and touch it up. Like, having a lot of data to train your models would be a more challenging use case. So yeah, model training requires probably a fair amount of preparation. Mm-hmm. In terms of document libraries and querying, our early indications are that, like, it's good to be organized, but it's querying documents and returning information that's probably useful and then passing it through generative AI. So for example, I upload 10 documents about my company, like past reports, etc. Some of these models are just giving you a chat interface with your documents where it's like, hey, what were some of the most interesting takeaways from last year's strategy deck? And you could upload 50 documents that are all a mess and poorly organized, but it's able to query that disorganized information in a simple way. And the same thing could be true for things like knowledge bases. And, you know, you can kind of just dump stuff into a model and have it return useful stuff. So it kind of depends on, I'm sure there's dozens of other use cases we've talked through, but that's why I say it kind of depends. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think that's really interesting. And, you know, for other entrepreneurs or founders that are listening to the podcast, I think that's also, you don't have to be super concerned about having all this documentation. Yes, but the process is broken down. Maybe not so much, especially if you're so focused on, you know, having your business survive.
May I highlight, we touched on something, but I think this is actually an opportunity that most folks don't recognize that is kind of newer, is synthetic data to train models. And so to break that down a little bit more, I need 1,000 pitches to train my model, 1,000 examples of what good looks like. Mm-hmm. I could, step one, train a general generative model on zero shot learning. So I could just say, here's instructions on how to write a pitch. And you fine tune your prompts until you're like, great, it output one that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then you can run that same thing with a high degree of variance to create 1,000 examples very, very quickly, and then have a human go through and edit, punch up, etc. But rather, you no longer would have to have a human go through and write 1,000 versions of a thing. You can accelerate that process probably 100 times by following that kind of a process. And that is actually, there's this whole debate of where do you get the data to train LLMs, and news providers are saying you can't scrape our content, and Google's complaining that, like, well, if we can't scrape the entire internet, how are we going to do it? Right. Well, there are a lot of companies that are using synthetic data to train massive models, and some of them are performing as well or better. I think there's a white paper out that showed that Microsoft followed a process like that. And yeah, in certain tasks, it can perform as well as better than models that are trained purely on human created content. So I would consider that if folks are looking at, shoot, I don't have the data to do what I want, you might be able to use AI to create the data to do what you want and have a nice little tight circle there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. This kind of touches on one of the points in one of the previous episodes. It gets a little bit philosophical, so maybe we can gleam over it. But it was about if AI becomes so proficient, right, and humans are using it all the time, then the data that typically AIs are fed is human created data. And if mm-hmm. humans become less proficient in their work, then there's less data for the AIs to be trained. And there might be a point where, you know, the learning capabilities of AI, because of the lack of data, goes down. But if the synthetic data is some sort of bolster to that, then maybe we don't have to worry about the slowdown of capacities of AI if the synthetic data is able to do kind of what true data is. Yeah.
It's a longer conversation an interesting one. Yeah. Early evidence is that synthetic data properly adjusted and with human-in-the-loop feedback cycles is able to do models that can probably outperform those that required human data. I don't know that it's about new human-created variants to create better models. I don't think that's, from what I've seen, I don't see that as a limitation, but your other guests might have had a different and more nuanced perspective than I'm.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, I think it was a little bit up in the air. But this is already a couple of weeks ago, so maybe it's already irrelevant.
I mean, it's a whole new world.
Yeah. Maybe we can move on to. So we talked about GPTs a little bit. We're talking about AI and generative AI and kind of this general broad framework. Maybe we can. Or you can pinpoint a little bit about some of the specific AIs that are being used with your work. And I think you mentioned GPTs being the newer variant out there.
Yeah. So a high level summary of what we're seeing is OpenAI is one of many companies that are going in this direction. I couldn't point to other specific ones that have done exactly this, but there's a clear trend in the direction of a core generative AI model that can take inputs from different places. I think people might be familiar with this in Bing search. You say, hey, what's the weather somewhere? And then it shows you querying the internet, returning data, and then it writes you a summary. But what it's really doing is like a nice wraparound layer of text generation on a piece of data that was returned from a third-party data source. Mm. Same thing from Kayak search or whatever. You're querying data, might be the internet, might be an internal database, something like that. And then it's taking that as an input for your models. We were working on a version of this using technology called LangChains, which is like you have to have a master controller model and you have to kind of branch out like, you know, how do you know? Do I query the documents? Do I query a database? Do I just use my own internal knowledge? And so we were, starting to hack away at ways of doing a chat with our platforms called Preston, chat with Preston based on a kind of hack together framework. And what OpenAI did with these GPTs, these assistants that they're rolling out, is that they built a framework that makes it really easy to do that. So it's tremendously useful for creating your own, like your own customized version of ChatGPT for a specific use case that has access to specific information or data. So to make it super practical, our chat bot that chat with Preston is pre-trained with information about a specific domain, public relations. So we did some light training on the chat bot. So it now knows fundamentals of PR because we've loaded in examples and prompts and things like that. So it has basic PR domain knowledge. That's a nice starting point. But it's not really new. That's kind of like you start your chat with GPT and you say, hey, you're a PR pro. I'm going to ask you some questions. And I was like, okay. Like you could kind of approximate something like that with ChatGPT, and it wasn't great, but it was going in that direction. Mm-hmm. What's a lot more interesting is now you can upload documents into a document library that it can query, and you can have a chatbot that's based on a fixed knowledge set. So we can upload, our entire structure is based around a platform that really knows a specific client and the news that matters for them. We process 10 million articles a month. Guaranteed, most of those are not relevant for, go back to our data privacy company. They're not going to care about most of the news that we're processing, but there is this very specific world that they care about, stories, journalists, et cetera. And so we can load documents into the platform that we can then interact with via this model. So I can say, I use this example, like, what are some of the more interesting facts from last year's strategy report? And it will give me that information. Right. So we can also do things to take it one step further. We can do things like write a pitch that incorporates the latest data from the clients, and it can do that. And this may sound kind of simple, but what's amazing is this ability to research, process, and put into a meaningful format is like such a core function for so many people in just day-to-day business activities. Writing an email newsletter or preparing a company report, or like, it's just going and looking for the thing and then putting it into a coherent output is a fundamental workflow that people are doing in so many different areas of business. We're doing a similar one that is doing research in preparation for sales calls. Like, here's the company, go out and research this thing and prepare for me these information. This isn't a focus of our company per se. It's just, that's a nice little thing I can hack together on a few hours over the weekend and be like, now I have a sales assistant so that I have all the information I need in a deliverable that works for me. And so that is, depending on your industry, you can start to think of tons of applications. So we're looking at building this both into core platform operations to productize for third-party users, and also just, how do I make life easier for my team so they don't have to do things? And I just give them a link to, here's your chatbot, use this tool. And your early indications, really early indications, just came out a couple of weeks ago, but like, it's pretty good. And that directionally is where we're going to keep going.
This, I think, touches on maybe one of the most interesting and I would say maybe highly debated points when it comes to generative AI and the world of business and work. And that's, of course, the impact on jobs, right? So what you're talking about right there sounds very positive in the sense of, well, it can save my employees a ton of time. It can, I think there's some books out right now talking about, you know, the superpowered or the supercharged employee, you know, essentially working with these AI tools. What's your perspective on that? Do you think that it's really just supercharging, making your employees specifically vastly more efficient? Or is there some concern, maybe this is moving into the future aspects that we talked about before, that some employees down the line might be actually eradicated because these AI tools are just so much better?
The quote I like, I'm not sure if it's a cliche yet, is you're not going to be replaced by AI. You're going to be replaced by someone who knows how to use AI. Yeah. To me, that makes a lot of sense. I think that technology has the ability, properly used, to increase productivity. And so it might mean that the bar of productivity is raised because, of course, you have a tool. We expect you to have more outputs. And so I think that that is where AI is most likely going to continue to help, is that proactive teammates are using AI to get better results. We employ a team of, you know, one editor and six writers on our editorial team. And we have, I mean, we're an AI focused company and we do a lot with generative AI. Why do we have writers like on staff, and why is that team actually growing? Well, because there is a demand for really, really good content that's outside of the skill of what an AI can currently generate right now. Editors that we're writing to, they've upped their game. They're not allowing garbage content to go through their pipelines anymore. They're expecting a higher quality of content. If you want to write a byline, a contributed article, it's got to be good, it's got to be insightful, and it has to have something. And that said, our best teammates are the ones who have built their own little prompts. They're using AI to write their outlines. And they're using AI to deliver higher quality outputs. So we're walking the walk in that aspect of our company as well. I'll go in a direction that's a little different, but I think related, is that my personal hope is that AI will level the playing field. And I mean that in a couple ways. I live in Medellin, Colombia. My wife's Colombian, my kids, gringo paisa, he's like, the miti miti. And I'm raising a family here, and we have a team of people. We have people in 15 different countries. Some of them are native English speaking, some of them aren't. I just interviewed a guy on the QA for a QA position this morning, and his English is okay. But we talked in the interview. He was like, listen, your job is to communicate with the engineers in English to deliver great value, and just use GPT, man. Like if you're able to use tools to overcome the language barrier, you're good, you're talented. Like, what do I care if your spoken English is perfect or not? It really should have no impact on our business operations. And so for me, that is my personal ambition, is that things like native English ability or other things that were artificial barriers to entry can be largely wiped out, and that human skills will continue to be more valued, whether that's creativity, originality, strategy, relationship management. There's a lot of stuff that I think can be enhanced, and you can strip away some of the BS that stands between someone and a really a position that could offer value by the proper use of technology. And I we're trying to walk that walk, and I think that would be a very good outcome as someone who's personally and emotionally invested in the success of people in a wide range of countries.
That's really interesting. I also so I don't have a full-time team yet, but I do have a team of, let's say, 8 to 10 freelancers that I work with consistently. And a lot of them are, English is their second language. And I, if they're not using ChatGPT, they're damn well sure using ChatGPT within the first couple of weeks, because it's so much more beneficial for them as well. It's not just for me, but they're able to communicate better, their work is better, and they're able to get more clients, and overall it's beneficial for them. So I guess my one point on this is, much more so than the last like 20, 30 years, like the globalization of competition, I think, is just going to go like crazy with these AI tools that are supporting people from all over the world. Somebody over in, who knows, Bangladesh is able to do the same type of work as somebody in Canada, where I am right now, at a drastically lower price point, and it benefits them, significantly, and it benefits the, I guess, the business that they're working with as well. So it'll be really interesting to see this continue on as AI gets more powerful, and as you've mentioned, people become more used to using GPTs, or programming their own little models that they're able to support their own work with. It's a very interesting world.
I think that's a real possibility. I am not a macro economist, so I'd have a hard time predicting those things like true global shifts. But if you look at a on the microcosm level, individual people fulfilling individual jobs, I think that you can very easily see people who are living in developing places able to compete more readily with people in developing country within developed countries. And I think that's likely, and I don't have a good sense of the implications of that.
Well, we'll see over the next couple of years, because I don't think it's going to take too long.
It probably won't.
I see that our time is kind of winding down here. I do definitely want to touch on like the future aspects and what you see coming down the pipeline. But I think one thing that I've missed asking you is, you made it sound very kind of easy to implement these AI tools and, build these systems and help out the clients. What are some challenges that you have come up with, or that you faced over the last little while, implementing these tools?
I think you touched on the having the right data in the right format piece. That's for sure been slowing us down. We found some workarounds, but like that's a real challenge, preparing your data. I think that there's just so many surprises that come up in trying to train a model to do a specific thing and getting some really unexpected outcomes. So, for example, we've been hacking away at a model for geographic tagging of journalist coverage and publication coverage. So, to analyze what a journalist, the geographic focus of a journalist, over the last month or so has been a surprisingly a straightforward thing for us to solve. We have the data, we have inputs, articles, you analyze them in a proper way, you pre-train on a data set, like you can build that model. I am very surprised that training the same thing on publications has been so complicated. Mm. The same, one might think that you analyze the articles of a journalist and you can see the focus of that journalist geographically. You could probably do the same thing on publications. So it's proving to be a very different problem. So New York Times, for example, you want to understand the coverage of them. You can't just take the first, the most recent 50 articles or 100 articles, or even like we start getting into the thousands of articles, and it depends on news cycles and the sample size and the selection. You're getting just some unexpected things start happening. Mm. Like you start to see that, obviously the New York Times does not cover New York. If you took the name of the publication and the description of the publication, et cetera, it would start to bias in that way. So just unexpected things kind of like that. Another one would be getting outputs that are logically coherent, but not good. Mm. So I'll say it in this way. We were writing a personalization model to personalize emails to journalists. And so you take an input and you take the article and the pitch. I want to comment about this, and he just wrote an article about that. Let's take, you know, given pitch, given his recent coverage, let's write a nice little personalization line. And the downside is that's a much bigger problem than just input, write good output, because it would squeeze together, I saw your recent article on cat litter boxes, and therefore thought I'd want to write this new story. I thought I'd be interested in this story on cybersecurity. Mm. It's like, no, I mean, it is logically consistent that you, and it's following the instruction of the prompt, mm. but that doesn't make any sense. And a human would very quickly be like, what, why are you spamming me with this garbage? So that problem is actually not a GPT problem. It's not a generative AI problem. It's about making sure you're giving the model the right inputs. It's all the structure around the AI that has to be lined up really well. Otherwise, it's the old saying, garbage in, garbage out. Right. If you're not giving the right inputs to the models that are really, really good, you're still going to get garbage outputs. So those are some of the things that were that's pretty in the weeds, but that's what we're seeing on a day-to-day problem-solving basis.
Okay, interesting. I see we got.
Is there more there you wanted to touch on? I don't know if that answers the question.
I think
so.
Yeah,
at.
Yeah. I think it's pretty comprehensive with regards to some of the challenges. But I do see we got about 10 minutes left. So why don't we focus on what's coming next? Because that's also, sure. I mean, I got the name of the podcast right behind me. That's one of the main themes that the podcast touches on. So you know, we touched on, or you touched on a little bit of, you know, these. Whether we want to call them superpowered employees, you know, kind of growing over the next couple of years. What are some of the things that you have seen and will continue to shift? I think we talked about maybe 1 or 2 weeks ago when we first discussed, like you had a product coming out and it should have taken, let's say, a year, and you were able to produce it within 5 or 6 months or something like that. So you're able to cut down the time by half. Maybe you want to touch on that.
Yeah, so I've touched on a few things. I'll breeze over the ones that we've covered in depth. One is connected AI. Yeah. So models that can take inputs from different sources. That's going to go to internet connectivity, document connectivity, database connectivity, being able to intelligently take inputs from a wide variety of sources and being able to create better outputs. That's one. It's here and going to accelerate quite clearly from my perspective. Beyond that, you have cheaper, you know, the cost and cost, speed and performance. Like this is just the typical technology curve that you see in any kind of technological development. But we can now use better models at a scale that we never could have imagined 6 months ago. All right, okay, you could imagine it, but like it was not possible 6 months ago. We can use updated updated generators on a scale that just didn't make sense. I mean, we built a model to analyze not just the themes a journalist writes about, but the attributes of their coverage. Mm. So is this someone who's writing reviews? Are they citing data? Are they interviewing CEOs? And the only real way to do that is to massively analyze millions of articles to look for very specific things. And let's build some models, let's throw it at that, and we can process that at a cost that's manageable. And that matters, for example, in our industry, because you want to get a product review and you're pitching a journalist who's never done a product review. He's probably not going to write a product review about your company. So getting that, just throwing AI at a giant data problem, is going to become increasingly possible. So connected, cost, speed, proficiency, all of those things I think are going to be interesting and accelerating. There's a really interesting debate from my perspective, is where people choose to completely build their own models versus using these LLMs that are just very, as they become cheaper and cheaper, the need to develop your own in-house models for small to medium-sized businesses might decrease. Like, where, and we're seeing this shift. Previously, we were building a lot more fully custom models, and now, okay, we're choosing our LLMs that we're building on top of selectively, but now it might make more sense to just build a model on top of a pre-trained model because it's already there, and like the cost of doing it is just so cheap that we can do that now. So I think that's another trend that's coming up quite quickly. My world is very much so text-based, text analysis and categorization, but obviously there's a lot of fascinating stuff happening in image and video creation that I probably won't, I'm not the best person to speak about. But I'd say the last trend for me, which is big and takes us towards artificial generative general intelligence, is that you have recursive learning. And that's not the thing that most people focus on, I think, when they're looking at building like general AI, is you have the ability for these models to learn from past activities. And so a very simple application that we're building is, based on journalists you give thumbs up and thumbs down to, the system starts to recommend more folks like you. That is a light recursive learning process that will start to be applied on a small scale and a wide scale. So models that we're building now, it's learning your pitching style. It's learning your writing style. It's like, it can be baked into the design of the system that the system gets smarter over time because it's taking inputs that were outputs previously. So that's super microcosm. You're talking about, these models being trained off of data that was created by the models themselves. It's synthetic data that's then going back to train the same model. And so, of course, your social media draft writer can get better over time because, oh, they like this, let me learn from that and get better over time. And you zoom out on that and you start to have these processes where the models themselves are getting feedback and able to retrain themselves. And that's where there's a lot of fear and uncertainty and doubt in, like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But models that were not a far leap away at all from models that are, they're self-feeding, and there's a self-learning loop, an automated feedback loop that's allowing them to not just take them as inputs, but fundamentally retrain themselves based on the data that they themselves are creating. And I think that's, we're going to see a lot more acceleration in that space. Models that either actually are becoming smarter or are creating the illusion that the model is becoming smarter because the system in which the model lives is getting more intelligent.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm actually going to write a blog post this afternoon on it, so I'm going to look into it as much as I can. But this was the main concern with the whole OpenAI chaos that happened over the last couple of weeks, right, with this Q-star model. I think there were leaks, but we're not 100% sure on it. Correct me if I'm wrong. But it is the fear that this is a, whether it's self-aware or it's a recursive learning model where it's able to take the previous input and learn from it and improve.
Yeah, that is at the heart of the drama surrounding OpenAI and the firing and rehiring. I'd say I'm using the term recursive learning rather broadly. Like there's more, but I'm using that to mean systems that improve over time in a structured way. And what we're talking about with Open AI's project that was not disclosed is far more advanced than that. But I think it's a good way to think about it is models or systems that get smarter over time. You can see that accelerating the acceleration at a speed that could be very concerning. And I would see that from my opinion is that this is where safeguards should be carefully considered, because once you introduce a self-learning mechanism, you it could very quickly go in a direction you don't expect by slight degrees of misconfiguration. You aim for the moon, you're 1 degree off, you end up thousands or millions of miles, thousands of miles away. A model that isn't properly calibrated or doesn't have proper safety rails in place, it retrains itself a thousand times, and all of a sudden you're in a very weird place, and that could be concerning.
I think I see that our time is pretty much up here, but I think that the one example that comes to my mind, and I can't remember the exact name, but I think it was Facebook's algorithm that came out about a decade ago or something like that. I think the name was Tai, if I'm not mistaken, Tai or Tosh or something like that. And it was just a typical chat bot, right, that people could speak to. And within the course of, I think it was under 24 hours, it became a raging like Nazi, like just some of the worst things that were said on the internet, because all these people were training it to speak like that and think like that. So I think that that's maybe a warning message for a lot of people thinking about these self-learning models. Completely to your point of, you shoot for the moon and you're just a little bit off, and you can go really, really far off really quickly.
I forget whose law it is, but there's a law that in internet discourse, you're just like three or four conversation leaps away from like Nazis and Hitler. And it can get there quite quickly. I say as someone who's been my family's been affected by those things, I don't mean to take it lightly, but you get very care you can get off the rails really, really quickly.
Well, maybe that's a good place to end the conversation about,
Hey, it
thinking.
didn't take us long to get there, right?
Exactly.
Within an hour.
Self-fulfilling.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Awesome.
Absolutely. Real pleasure
Yeah,
to
absolutely.
connect. Really, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. Thank you for I mean, obviously sharing your insights, but also opening my mind a little bit more to some of these ideas. I will have Intelligent Relations, your business's website up on the show notes. Are there any other places that you want people to either reach out or follow your work that I can put up on there?
I really appreciate it. No, intelligent relations is my full-time passion, and company, and would love to have folks check it out and see if you can use the tech we're building and or the team to support to do PR and earn media coverage more effectively. So yeah, please
Perfect.
give us a shout.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for your time. And yeah, good luck with building some new AI GPTs to supercharge your employees over time.
It's a fun
Yeah,
challenge. Yeah.
absolutely. Thanks, Steve. Well, thanks for listening to this week's Future Tech and Foresight podcast. If you like what you've heard here, there are, of course, a number of ways that you can support the podcast. The best way would be to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or give a rating on Spotify, which you can find a step-by-step explanation for on the futuretechandforesight.com website. Alternatively, feel free to leave a comment either on the episode show notes or the YouTube channel where you can see video recordings of the interviews. And finally, if you are part of an organization that is aware of the disruptive and transformational impact that emerging and future technologies will bring and want to know more, please get in touch to hear about the strategic foresight services that we offer and how we can help future-proof your organization and take advantage of the phenomenal opportunities available to survive and thrive in the future.
A lot of future shock people and future shock institutions in our society are simply overwhelmed.
Once there is superintelligence, the fate of humanity may depend on what the superintelligence does.
Science fact is catching up to science fiction.
The first truly intelligent machine will be the last invention that humanity needs to make.
The only scarcity that will exist in the future is that which we decide to create ourselves as humans.
Within a 10-year design revolution, we can have all humanity living the highest and living anybody's ever known.
Progress is accelerating at an exponential pace, and it's going to reach a point where progress is so fast it's going to be a singularity.
We are probably one of the last generations of Homo sapiens.
Every single headline points to the birth pangs of a Type 1 civilization.